Okay, I just want to thank Ms. Rubin for arranging the shiur. It's very special how all of you come out on a cold night to arrange a shiur. It's very nice, especially one of you is not feeling well, and someone else is on the way to avort. I hear everything, and for shlema. So it's just kudos to all of you for coming out and making the effort to come out to grow and to be inspired together. There's something I wanted to discuss, something to talk about, that is we find in this week's parsha. In last week's parsha of Miketz, I always find that parsha's Miketz gets overlooked because it's always taken over by Chanukah. This week's parsha is Vayigash, and next week's Vayichi. So there's something that we find that the Mefarshim, the commentaries, point out, something very interesting. We find by Yosef. Yosef is the main character in these parshas, and we find so many times in these parshas of Miketz, Vayigash and Vayichi, that Yosef cries. We find many psukim again and again and again that Yosef is constantly crying. When the brothers came to him in the first place in Mitzrayim, it says Vayisov me'aleim vayev. In Perek Membeis, in Miketz, it says that he turned from them and he had to cry. Then the brothers went back home and they came back to Mitzrayim. They brought Binyamin, and it says Vayivakesh Livchlis. He wanted to cry, so Vayavay Achadra Vayev Shama. He turned away and he cried over there. Then in this week's Parshas Vayigash, when Yosef revealed himself to his brothers, he said Vayitenes Kalo Bivchi. He gave out his voice Bivchi and cry, and then he revealed himself. Then Binyamin came, and it says Vayibal Atzavarei Binyamin Ochi Vayev Ku Binyamin Bocha Atzavarov. And he saw Binyamin, his only full brother from both parents, and he cried, they both cried, his brother also cried, on his shoulders. And then the next pasuk it says, he kissed every one of his brothers, and he cried on them as well. Then Yaakov came down, it says, and he cried again on Yaakov. And then in Parshas Vayechi, it says, when Yaakov died, he fell on Yaakov, his father, and he cried over there. And then when the brothers asked them to, you know, to forgive him and not hold it against them, they say, "Vayif Yosef Bedabrim Alav." When Yosef cried when they were speaking to him. So if you lost count, that was 8 different psukim already that it says that Yosef cried. And we find many times, you know, people cry here and there, but so many times that we find that Yosef cries, and not only does he cry, but we find that the Torah felt it important to tell us again and again that Yosef was crying. We find not only by Yosef, but we find by Yosef's mother. His mother was Rachel, and the pasuk says, the famous pasuk in Yirmiyah, Rachel mavak al banel, Rachel was crying over her children, and so much so that Hashem has to tell her, "Mini kolech mibechi, hold back your tears. You should stop crying." Right? That's a famous pasuk. It was famous even before Shweki came along and made it into a song. But for sure, once he came along, that's a famous pasuk. Happens to be that song. I'm sure you know which song I'm talking about. Mama Rachel, cry. Yeah, so that's on Journey. So that song, if you look on the jacket of the CD, that song is based on a story with Reb Chaim Shulevitz. This pasuk, Hashem is telling Rachel to stop crying. Reb Chaim Shulevitz, whose yahrzeit was today, that's why I'm just pointing it out, Reb Chaim Shulevitz used to go to Kever Rachel, and he used to daven by Kever Rachel, and he used to say, "Mama Rachel, and Hashem tells you to stop crying, but your son Chaim, he tells you, you know, please continue to cry." So today was Reb Chaim Shulevitz's yahrzeit. I happen to know Gimel Tevis because it's my birthday, so the same day as his yahrzeit. So that song is based on that. But that's a famous pasuk that you see not just Yosef, but also he's getting it from his mother to cry aloud. So I know for myself that, you know, sometimes you want to cry, like Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, and like you try to cry, but it just, you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen. But Yosef, we see he was able to cry so much. So what's the meaning in that? So the Arizal says that the tears, when a person cries, a person's tears, the Arizal says, and other Sfarim Kedoshim, they say that that's coming from the neshama. That's coming from the inside of a person, the pnimius, the inside of a person. When he cries, that's the neshama shedding. That's the tears come from the neshama, from the pnimius of a person. We know the neshama is inside of us. Every morning we say, Moida'ani lefanecha melech chai v'kayam shechazarta bi nishmasi. My neshama is bi, my neshama is inside of me. And it's based on a pasuk in Eicha. The pasuk in Eicha says, Eini oilel al nafshi. My eyes, they have brought grief to my soul, meaning my soul, my eyes. My first say that it's when Yirmiyah was crying, that was coming out from his soul, coming out from his nefesh, from his neshama. And that's where the tears come from. So Yosef, when he was able to cry so much, because Yosef was totally connected with his pnimius, with the inside, he was one with his neshama inside of him, and he was best able to express himself through his crying. That's why we find girls and women, they cry so much more than men. The statistics show that women cry more than men, and there's many different reasons why, different explanations, but the real answer is, what we believe, is because the Gemara tells us that women and girls have a bina yisera. They have an extra understanding. They're more in touch with themselves. They're more in touch with their inner selves. They understand themselves better. They're more connected to their neshama. If they're more connected to their neshama, they're able to connect to it, they're able to relate to it in some way better than men. And this way they're able to cry much more freely. They're able to express themselves much, much easier with the crying. I know I teach in the Beis Yaakov in Passaic where I live, and I remember after the first report card that I gave, I learned very quickly that girls cry very easily. And I was approached by one girl, especially in front of the whole class after class, and you know, she's crying about the grade that I gave her, and I'm like, you know, how did I get myself into this? But you know, I didn't give in to her because she got the grade she deserved. But the girls, they able to cry, they're able to express themselves much easier by crying, much more than men. And in general, women are more internal than men. Everything for the woman is inside, right? But a husband and wife, how does a baby, what does the mother carry her baby? She carries the baby inside her stomach. As far as the man is concerned, the baby is outside his stomach. Everything is internal. As a matter of fact, I'm sure you all know that girls are potter from mitzvah saseh shazman grama. They are exempt from all mitzvos that come at a set time, meaning mitzvos like tefillin and tzitzis and lulav and sukkah and shofar, mitzvos that come at a set time, women are exempt. They're not obligated to do it. Certain mitzvos, they are allowed to volunteer and do those mitzvos, like sukkah, you're allowed to eat in a sukkah, even Ashkenazim, we hold, you even make a bracha. Lulav and shofar, it's more than just you're allowed to, but it's already been accepted upon themselves. Women have accepted to hear shofar every year and to shake the lulav on sukkahs. Tefillin and tzitzis, for different reasons why women do not volunteer and do those mitzvahs. But technically they're potter to do those mitzvahs. Just one funny story with that, with the tefillin. We all know that women don't put on tefillin, don't wear tzitzis. There were some exceptions. Anyone know which women put on tefillin? There were a few exceptions many, many years ago. Right, very good. Rashi's daughters. So Rashi's daughters, they used to wear tefillin. And you'll find, you know, the feminists say, oh, Rashi's daughters wore tefillin, and Micha Basho, she wore tefillin, but it's accepted already that women do not wear tefillin. Barrow Wine, I'm sure you've heard of Barrow Wine, he made a biography on Rashi. It was a video, it was about a half hour video. It was a very interesting video about Rashi, and I watched the video. So one of the things that he made on the video was like an animated video. And one of the things that he made on the video was Rashi's daughters wearing tefillin. So now it's documented, and supposedly it's true, and it's really true that Rashi's daughters were tefillin. But I was watching the video with somebody else, and he was saying, you know, even if it's true, why did he have to put it on? Why is it necessary to put it on? Fine, I wasn't bothered by it so much, you know, fine. So there was something famous about Rashi, that his daughters were tefillin. So my father, Rav Pesach Kron, is very good friends with Rav Barrow Wine through the speaking. So I became very good friends with Rabbi Arwine's grandson when I was in Yeshiva in the Mir in Eretz Yisrael. So he invited me over one time to eat the Shabbos Suda. So naturally the topic came up of the video on Rashi, because you know, he was the one that made it. And I had forgotten that he was the one that made the video. It slipped my mind that I knew I had seen the video, but it slipped my mind that he was the one that made the video. So the topic came up about Rashi's video, and I said, yeah, someone was upset that they put on that Rashi's daughters were tefillin. So he said, well, yeah, well, some people don't like the truth, so, you know, that's why I put it on. And then I realized, like, oh my gosh, she was on. I was like, yeah, that's what I told them, you know, for sure, 100%. But generally speaking, women do not wear tefillin. And the reason why, the Mefarshim say, the reason why women are pater from mitzvah saseh shazman grama, the Gemara learns it out from a pasuk, but the commentaries try and give reasons, is they say that women do not need those mitzvos that are bound by time. Men are outwardly people. They're always running, they're going, and they're doing, and they go out to work, and they go all around, and they need mitzvos at a set time to, so to speak, rein them in, and to bring them in, and to focus their minds on the mitzvos, on the Torah, because they're busy doing so many other things. Women, on the other hand, they're internal people. They're inside by themselves. They don't need to. Okay, nowadays people, they go out and they shop and they work. It's not a problem. But since they're more in general, they're more internal people, they don't need those extra mitzvos to rein them in at that time. There's midrashim that say that the woman has her tefillin inside her head, and everything that she has is all internal. And because of that, she's not obligated to do those mitzvos. We say in davening every morning, a man says, Shelo asani isha, right? But Berachas HaShachar, Shelo asani isha. We thank Hashem for not making us a woman. We're not saying anything bad about a woman, that we don't want to be an isha. But the reason is, Rashi simply explains that a man has extra mitzvos because we are obligated in all the mitzvos. So we thank Hashem that we're able to do all those mitzvos. We're obligated to do those mitzvos. We're just thanking Hashem that we have more mitzvos. What does a girl say? A girl says, instead of Shalai Sani Isha, they say, they don't say Shalai Sani Ish, but they say Shasani Kirtzaina. And Hashem made me in His will. So the B'nai Yisoschar says an incredible pshat. He says what it means is that Hashem made us like His will, meaning the way He would really want us to be, in a perfect state, meaning women are, so to speak, on a higher madriga, higher level than men. Men need to do those other mitzvos to bring them up to that higher level, and we get more schar for that because we have those mitzvos, but women already are on that higher level. They don't need that those extra mitzvos. Shasana kirtzona, that Hashem made us like His will in that perfect state. Yosef, what was Yosef famous for? Besides for the crying, Yosef was famous for his dreams and for interpreting dreams, right? We know that's how he got out of jail. Yosef had the koyach, he had the ability to interpret dreams. Dreams, the Gemara tells us that dreams go after a person's interpretation. Whatever the interpreter says, whatever the person says, that's what's going to happen with the dream. The Gemara tells us an interesting story about Abaya and Rava, that Abaya and Rava for many nights in a row, they had the same dream. The same exact dream. And they went to the same interpreter, and one of them paid the interpreter for his services, and one of them did not. And the interpreter, for the one who paid him, he gave a good interpretation. And for the one that did not pay him, he did not give a good interpretation, and everything exactly that the interpreter said came true. Good for the one that he interpreted good for, and bad for the one he interpreted bad for, again and again and again and again. That's a good question. Whichever was the one, Abaya or Rava, that wasn't paying, why didn't he just learn his lesson and start to pay? I don't know, you have to look up the Mefarshim over there, but you see that it was the same exact dream, and for one person he interpreted positively, and another one he interpreted negatively. It was whatever he said, that's what came out. It goes after the interpretation. Speech, the speech that would say the interpretation, speech is also something that's internal. Speech comes from inside of us. The Pasuk in Parshas Bereishis says that when Hashem created Adam, Hashem created man, Vayipach ba'apov nishmas chayim, Hashem blew inside of us, again, inside of us, nishmas chayim, the neshama, and Unkelis says, what does that mean? Ruach memalala. That a spirit that we're able to talk. That's what we have over the other creations, over the animals and the plants and the malachim, that we're able to talk. We have speech. Speech also comes from inside of us. And Yosef, who was so in touch with his internal being, he was in touch with his neshama, with his inside of him, his speech was on a higher level. And his interpretations, he was able to connect to dreams with his speech, together with the fact that he's able to cry, that he's so in touch with himself, he was able to give that higher level of speech. What's a dream? A dream, how do we say dream in Hebrew? Is a chalom. A chalom is a dream. And it sounds similar to the word chaloin, which is a window. And the Mefarshim constantly make connections between words that sound alike, even if there's a little bit of a difference in the letters. But if they sound alike, there's a connection. Mefarshim tell us that the dream is the window to inside of our souls, to inside of us, to inside our neshama. If a person wants to see how they look on the outside, so you look in the mirror. How does a person know what's going on inside of them? So a person, if he's on that level, his dreams, his or her dreams, could tell him what's inside of him. It could tell a person what they're thinking throughout the day. It could, sometimes there's messages from Hashem, it's Ruach HaKodesh or not, it's probably not Ruach HaKodesh, but there's some messages that Hashem could give to big tzaddikim through their dreams, because that shows that the dream comes from inside them and it's able to connect through Hashem, through the neshama, it's connected, and you could get special messages from Hashem through your dream, which comes from inside of you. That is the window to your soul. There's a famous expression that the eyes are the window to the soul. That it could be you've heard of, that the eyes are the window to the soul. That's also based on that pasuk in Eicha that we said before, Eini oilu lo lenafshi. My eyes bring grief to my soul, because that is the direct connection to my neshama inside, is through my eyes, which is why when a neshama cries, the tears come out. It's not a coincidence, it could be, that when does a person dream? At what point in their sleep? Anybody know? At what point in their sleep do they dream? Are the dreams the most intense? During the REM sleep, REM, which is the rapid eye movement. when the eyes flicker, when a person, if you would watch somebody sleep, when their eyes are flickering, when they're rapid eye, when they're moving the fastest, that, the studies show, that is when the person's dreams are the most intense, because the person's dreams are connected to their eyes. Studies show also that during the rapid eye, during REM sleep, during the rapid eye movement sleep, a person's heart rate is the fastest. And that's the heart. The heart, the lave, is inside of us. Lave is our panemius. That is the ultimate panemius, is our lave. Lave is the gematria 32, and bechi, right? Bechi is crying. It's also bechi is 32, also the gematria of lave. Because the bechi, the crying, comes from our soul, from inside of us. Chanukah is over with already, but we just finished the Yantav of Chanukah, and in short, that's really what Yavan was really out to get, and to go to stop from Klal Yisrael. What was Yavan all about? Yavan was all about competition and the goof, the outside. They were the ones who made up the Olympics. They wanted results. They wanted the outside. They wanted to see what was going to be on the outside, the results, the competition, and who's going to win at the end. They didn't care if you know that inside you tried your hardest. In Yiddishkeit, we know that it depends on the amelus, on the yagia, on how hard we work, on what's inside. We know it inside how hard we tried, even if we didn't come up with the final product. But Yavan was not like that. Yavan was, everything was chitzonius. Everything was the outside. They wanted the final result. They wanted the competition, the results. They wanted to see who's going to win first place. If you could picture the Yud, the Vav, and the Nun, the end of Nun, the Nun Sofis, of the word Yavan, all those three letters, the Yud, the Vav, and the end of Nun, there's no pnimius, there's no inside to those letters. It's just a straight line. Yud is a very short line, and Vav is a little longer, and the end of Nun is very long. There's no pnimius, there's no inside. All other letters in the Aleph Beis have an inside. Besides the Samach and the end of Mem that are totally enclosed, but every other letter, if you take a lamed, a mem, a tes, there's all an inside, a panemius, to all the other letters. But Yavan was against the panemius. They were totally the outside, and that's why their name makes up letter, is made up of letters that have no panemius whatsoever. That's why they were against Bris Milah. What's Bris Milah? They wanted to stop Klal Yisrael from doing the Bris Milah, because they felt that that's ruining the guf, that's ruining the chitzonius of a person. Klal Yisrael, why do we do Bris Milah? I'm a male, so I take it to heart. But why do we do Bris Milah? Because as the Psukim tell us in Parshas Veschanan and Parshas Ekev, that's supposed to help us for the Arlas HaLev, for the Lev, which is the Panemius, like we said before. The Arla on the outside, that takes care of the Arlas HaLev, which is the Panemius. So we know that Bris Milah is something that's connected to our Panemius. They looked at it as something that's totally on the Chitzenius, and you're messing around, you're ruining the Chitzenius. So that's why they were against it. Okay, we're not going to talk so much about Hanukkah because Hanukkah's over. But again, you see that idea that Klal Yisrael, all we care about is the panemius, the inside of each individual. Klal Yisrael in general, all over, we always care about the panemius. I'll tell you a beautiful story that happened a number of years ago, about 30 years ago. There was a baby that was born, and he was born premature, and he was born just over 2 pounds. And just over 2 pounds is tiny. I know for a bris, we wait till the baby's at least around 5 pounds. There was no way this baby was able to have his bris on time. And at first, doctors weren't even 100% sure that he would be able to survive. He was born so premature. Eventually, Baruch Hashem, the doctors told the parents that he would be able to survive. But they told him that even after he was able to leave the hospital, he was able to have his bris. But they said he was going to have many problems, and he's going to be very slow in certain areas in his life. And they said one thing that he's going to have is that he's always going to be very short. He's always going to be very short. So fine, the parents were happy at least that their child was able to survive. And sure enough, as he grew older, 3 years old, 4 years old, 5, 6, 7, he was always the shortest in his class. And he was always ridiculed. He was called Pee-wee and Shrimp, and he was always made fun of, you know, whenever they use an opportunity to make fun of a kid. And the parents always tried to, you know, boost him up, give him confidence, and say good things and come in small packages, and diamonds are small. And he used to tell him that, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein was short, and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was short. A lot of the gedolim that we had were short, and they tried to, you know, boost his confidence. In 1985, there came out a new drug, a new hormone, that the doctors claimed would be able to spurt a person's growth. And they weren't positive about it. And of course, anytime there's a new drug, a new hormone, a new steroid, they were worried that there were going to be possible side effects. But they did claim that it was going to be able to spurt somebody's growth. So of course, the parents, they had this dilemma. They weren't sure. Should they give this medicine to their child? They weren't sure. And they discussed it with doctors and they discussed it with Rabbanim. They flew to New York to the top endocrinologist in a big hospital, and they got a meeting with her, and they sat with her for some time discussing the pros and the cons. And finally, this man, the Yid, he said to the doctor, he said, who is a non-Jew, who's a guy, and he said to her, "Let me ask you, if it was your child, what would you do? I'm asking you as a mother, not as a doctor. If it was your child, would you give this medicine, this steroid, to your child?" And he said that she had to close her eyes, and when she opened her eyes were red, and she had been crying. And she said, "Rabbi, I'll tell you, there's a big difference between me and you, between my people and your people." She said, "Your people is a people of Pinemius," she didn't say Pinemius, but she said, "Your people is only internal people. They care about what's inside. My people is different like that. I live in a neighborhood where everything is on the outside. What car you drive and what house, how fancy your house is, everything's on the outside. I would have no choice. I would have to give this steroid to my son. If he was going to be short, everything's based on first impressions and how you look on the outside. I would have no choice. I would have to. But I know, Rabbi, that your people are different. You care about what's on the inside. If I were you, I wouldn't give the medicine." And sure enough, that based on that, he said that he got such a musar shmuz from a goyish lady, a goyish doctor, he got such a musar shmuz that all we care about is the inside. And sure enough, they decided not to give this medicine to their child. This child grew up, and he ended up getting married to my second cousin. And I remember seeing a picture of them. I didn't go to the Vart because it was out of town, but I remember seeing a picture of them, and sure enough, his Kala, his wife, is taller than him. He's taka very short, but you see that the parents made the right decision. He got married, Baruch Hashem, he has a family, and he was stressing the fact that, again, by Klal Yisrael, all we care is about the Pnimius, the inside, and what's on the outside, we can't judge based on the outside. If a person has this midah, that they are in connection with themselves, they able to connect, and they have their own self-dignity, their own self-respect, and they have their own self-confidence because they're confident in their own, and they know that they are okay, this could have a positive effect on so many different areas in a person's life. You'll notice that most fights and most grudges that people have between each other and conflicts between two people comes because one of the people, and for sure if both, they lack this nekuda, they lack this self-identity, they're not confident with themselves, they're not happy with how they are themselves. If they're nervous that people, oh, they're going to look down at me, and oh, that person said that to me because they look down at me, and they think I'm doing something wrong, and I'm not getting into the halachic aspects of Maris Ayin, how a person has to be careful that it doesn't look like they're doing something halachically wrong. But besides that, if a person knows that their life is not dictated by others, because they know they're at peace with themselves, they know they're fine with how they are. Somebody maybe said a nasty comment to them, or someone you think, oh, how they're gonna look at me? What are they gonna say? You don't have to worry about it because you know that you're doing the right thing. You know you're following the Torah and mitzvahs, and you're doing correct. You're okay with yourself. You have your own self-confidence that you know that you're fine. You ever sit around the table, everyone's benching, let's say after a Shabbos meal, everyone's benching, and you don't want to be the first one to finish benching. So you're already at the end of benching, you know what I'm talking about? And you know, you fast, and you know, this happens to me at times. I admit it happens to me, and like, you don't want to be the first one, so you're like, you just, you know, mumble, you move your mouth. I guarantee you that if a person said every word in benching, and they had the proper kavana, and they're the first one to finish benching, they'll have no problem with it. Why is the problem person bothered? Oh, I'm the first one finished. I'm the first one finishing Shemona Esrei, right? You're standing, let's say, in school, or you're standing somewhere, or in shul, and you don't want to be the first one to take the three steps back. You're looking around, because you know, if you know you said every word in Shemona Esrei, and you had kavana 100%, you have no problem. So fine, everybody else davens longer than you. Not a big deal. You know you're okay. You're fine with yourself. If you're looking at other people and you're worried about what they're going to think, then that's an indication that a person is not 100% happy with themselves. I'll tell you an amazing story that shows that somebody that they were fine with how they are themselves and they didn't have to worry about what other people are going to say. This story takes place right after the Holocaust. There was a man that Nebuch, he lost his wife in the Holocaust, and he survived. And shortly after the Holocaust was over, he tried to start his life anew, and he got remarried. And he told his wife, his second wife, that he has nothing left from his previous marriage. Everything's lost. The only thing he has left, he has one thing left, and that is a picture. A picture of him and his wife, his first wife. And he said, I understand if it bothers you that I have this picture, if it makes you feel uncomfortable that I still have this picture of my first wife that was never killed. And I'm going to put this picture away. I'm going to put it on the bottom of, let's say, my sock drawer, underneath my sock drawer. And if at any point it bothers you that this picture is here in the house, and it bothers you that you know that I still have this picture, by all means, I'm telling you where it is. You could go right ahead. You could take it out, and you could throw it out if it bothers you. But I can't throw it out. I can't bring myself to get rid of this picture. It's the only thing I have left from my first wife. But I'm just telling you where it is. Fine. He puts it over there. He shows her where it is. He puts it underneath the socks. Later that day, he comes back, and he sees that his sock drawer has been gone through, and he sees it's moved around. And he moves, and he sees it's not there. And he realized that, he thought that, it just must have been too hard for his second wife to come to grips with the fact, to grasp the fact that, he still had this picture and he still loved his first wife. So fine, what could he do? As he stands up from his drawer, he turns around and he sees the picture on the wall in a frame. And he sees that that's why the picture wasn't there. His wife had taken the picture and put it on the wall in a frame. And that is, your heart could fall out from that story. And you see that, she could have said, people think it's weird. It's a picture of my husband with his first wife. It's a weird thing to have. But she knew, I'm fine. And I'm sure he loves me. But this is something that is important to him. And it's something that he feels he can't get rid of. He can't get rid of the picture. She had her own self-confidence, her own self-dignity, her own self-respect. That the fact that he has a picture, he still wants to hold on to such a picture, is not anything that is against me. And she had no problem of hanging up the picture on the wall for him. A little bit of a lighter story, which I always remember, and this story sticks in my mind. I lived in Eretz Yisrael for 5 years after I got married, and so those of you who have been to Eretz Yisrael, those who have been to seminary in Eretz Yisrael, you know that a lot of times you come to, let's say, a shul or a public place, and the water from the sinks, it goes, like underneath by the floor, and you could see the floor, like there's these grates on the floor, and sometimes when it gets stuffed up, the water seeps through. And I was once by a bris in Eretz Yisrael where it was all stuffed up, and the water was coming up, and it was dirty water that people were using from the sink after they washed the Tilos Yadayim, and the people were stepping on it. And every single person that came to wash over there, they would see the water, and every single person, including myself, said the same thing. Anyone see the janitor? Is there a janitor over here anywhere? Does anyone know where he is? Could someone go call him? But Nobody did anything about it. They just, walked around it. They tried to not step in it too much. Finally, one of my friends, one of the young lights from my chabura, so he went over, he saw a sponge stick. Those of you, I'm sure you all know what a sponge stick, those of you who've been to Eretz Yisrael, he got a sponge stick in his hat and jacket, and he started sponging, and he started moving the water away from everybody, and he got it out, just whatever the janitor would have done when he got there. So this guy, he was in his full hat and jacket, but it needed to be done. Makom she'enish, nobody was doing it. So he did it. So another one of my friends, he said that anybody who could sponge up in a hat and jacket in public must have such self-confidence and such confidence, full of self-esteem that he doesn't have to worry, what are people going to say? It doesn't look nice for a yeshiva man, for a chash of a person, to sponge over there in a hat and jacket. He didn't care. This is what needs to be done, and I don't have to worry about what other people are going to say. Plenty of times you do have to worry what other people are going to say. You can't be disrespectful and not nice to somebody. You have to care about other person's feelings. But as far as what people are going to say about you, if you know you're doing the right thing, you don't have to worry about the fact that what people have to say about you. You know you're doing correct. You're following the Torah. You're following the mitzvahs. As long as you're not stepping on anybody else's toes and you're not insulting or hurting anybody else, as long as you're okay with your panemius, you're okay with yourself, then a person is not going to be worried about what other people are going to say, and that could prevent so many different fights and so many lines given back to each other. Fine, so somebody said something not nice to me. I'm willing to forgo. I'm willing to give in. I know I did what was right, and that person tells me, oh, you should have done this and that. I know I did right, whether I spoke to people about it first, I made a decision, my own calculated decision, they don't realize what's going on in my life, or I spoke to Das Torah, I spoke to Rav or something, I know that what I did is correct, and I'm not going to be bothered when other people seemingly step on my toes. I'm able to be Mavre Amidosa, I'm able to give in, and I won't have to worry. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Ezu mechubud hamechabe desabrios. Who is someone that's honorable, that's respectful? Someone who's able to honor others. Somebody who's able, you see that somebody is able to honor others, so they are an honorable person. Why? Where does that come from? And that's the same idea. Some of the Mefarshim explain, because you'll notice some people, they can't compliment others. I know people like that, and it's very unenjoyable. It's not comfortable to be around such people. They can never bring themselves to compliment somebody. I'm not talking about complimenting Rabbi Yashiv and Rabbi Chaim Kanevsky and the Chafetz Chaim and the Vilna Gaon. Anyone could compliment that, can compliment them. But they feel hard, like, to compliment other people that are on their same wavelength. Why? Because they're afraid that if they compliment other people, so then, you know, I'm saying that person has a maila that, you know, that maybe I don't have, and then I'm less than that person. So they can't bring themselves to compliment. Yeah, you know, they can't compliment somebody who went to this yeshiva, or you can't compliment somebody who went to that Beis Yaakov or that seminary, because I'm afraid if I say compliments to other people, then it shows that maybe I'm not on that level, or I'm not as good as her or him. But of course, that's nonsense. If a person has that self-respect, and they're confident with themselves, and they know they're good, and they could compliment people, it's the most pleasurable thing to be around people that compliment. And I know, as we just had PTA meetings for the parents of the students that I teach, and you know, they all tell you that anytime you don't, whenever you want to say something bad about a student, although the parents that come are never the parents of the girls that you want to come, they're always the perfect students, those are the ones whose parents come. But a few parents that you want to say something negative, so of course you have to start off with something positive. You know, you have to look, there's always something positive to say about somebody else. And there's always what to compliment. Sometimes you have to look harder than others, than other people, but there's always what to compliment. There's always good people out there, and there's always positive things to compliment about people. People who can't bring themselves to compliment others is because they lack their own self-confidence. I just heard a story today from my father. I listen to my father's tapes just as much as everybody else, and I was traveling today somewhere else, and I was listening to my father. My father must have just heard this story, because I never heard this story before. Just an amazing story about just something that's just so beautiful. Mika Amcha Yisrael, a beautiful thing that he did. Story took place in England. It must have happened recently, because it's a new story for my father, that there's a job, and in all the yeshivas and all the beisakas, there's one person that's designated to collect the tuition, and they have to, and it's a very not pleasant job, and everybody hates the guy, because he's running after everybody for their money, and he's telling everybody how much really they could afford to pay tuition. I know, because Kanainara, I have kids in yeshiva, and they're telling us, you know, they want to see our bank accounts, they want to know what was the last vacations that we took, and what type of cars we own, and we have to give them bank statements to see, and it's not an enjoy. Everyone hates the guy who has a job, but there has to be somebody who has that job. So there was this person in England who, he made a phone call to somebody, and he said, listen, he said, you owe us £2,000. Pounds is the currency in England. He says, you owe us £2,000. And, you know, we need to pay the rebellion. We need the money. He says, okay, fine, no problem. You know, I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of the £2,000. Fine, great. He hangs up. About a month and a half passes by. Nothing happens. He did the man, he doesn't get anything. No letter sent to the yeshiva. No checks sent to the yeshiva. After about, you know, 6-7 weeks, he calls the guy back, and he says, listen, you know, remember we spoke about 6-7 weeks ago that, you know, you owe £2,000? He says, what do you mean? I took care of it the next day. He says, what are you talking about? I never got anything. He says, what do you mean? The next day I went to your house, I saw your son, your little boy, playing outside the house. I gave him an envelope with £2,000 in it. He didn't give it to you? He says, no, he didn't give me anything. So he goes home, he asks his son, do you remember somebody gave you an envelope with money in it? He's a little boy, he doesn't remember. He says, I have no idea. So he calls the guy back. He says, listen, I don't want to have to take you to Din Torah, but, you know, you say you gave it to my son, my little boy, and I don't know if I should believe you. And it's irresponsible to give it to a child. He says, listen, I don't know what to tell you. I gave it to your child. He says, you know what, I'll do you a favor. I'll ask around my neighbors, maybe some of the people on the block, maybe they saw the envelope. He says, fine, do your best. So he goes around, he asks his neighbors. finally goes to one of his neighbors a few houses down, and he says, you know, by any chance, did you see a white envelope that was not marked on the street, on the sidewalk somewhere about you know, a month and a half ago? He's like, yeah, with £2,000? He's like, yeah. He says, oh. He says, a month and a half ago, I was laid off of my job. It was right before Pesach. I had no money for Yontif. I couldn't even bring myself to walk inside my house to tell my wife that I don't have money for Yontif. I'm walking down the street, and I see an envelope with £2,000 in it. And I said, it was like mamish mon from Shemayim. It was sent straight from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I took the money, and that's the money we spent on Yontif. So he says, you know, that money belongs to the yeshiva. He says, I feel terrible. He says, 100%. He says, listen, I still don't have a job. I can't pay you the £2,000 right now, but definitely, you know, the money belongs to the yeshiva. I'll get it to you over monthly installments. You know, I'll pay it back to the yeshiva 100%. You know, I feel terrible, but I'll definitely give you the money. So this, you know, this person from the tuition man, so he calls back the other guy, and he says, I found your £2,000. It was by a neighbor, and he told him the story exactly what happened, that the neighbor got laid off from the job, and he used the money to pay for Yontif, and now he still doesn't have a job, but he'll pay it back. Don't worry, you know, you're taken care of. So he says, that, you know, he and Ani, a poor man, tell him that he could keep the £2,000, I'll pay the £2,000 separately. And, you know, just an amazing story. This guy had money. He just, for whatever reason, he hadn't paid his tuition, but he had the money. And here he saw a poor man. He was able to give him the £2,000. Just a beautiful, just on my mind, because I heard the story today. Just there's so many chesedim, so many beautiful things that Klal Yisrael is doing out there. And there's so many opportunities to compliment people, to compliment organizations, and to compliment different sect of life, that we don't have to focus on the negative. We could always, there's always what positive to look at. This nekuda can help us so much with being dan lekaf schus as well. We have so many times that we see other people doing things, and you know, the pasuk tells us, "Betzedek tishpo desami secha." The pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, and the simple meaning is going on the courts, on the judges, that we have to judge favorably. But Rashi brings the Gemara that it's going on every single one of us, that we all have to be down the kafskos. We have to judge somebody favorably. We see somebody do something and or make a decision, and you think, you know, they're wrong, they're doing bad. You don't have to worry about what other people are doing. You say they must have had a reason. I'm sure that I don't know the whole story. We know, we all know from ourselves that people sometimes judge us in a wrong way, and people don't know the whole story. They don't know what went into certain things that we do, certain things that we are forced to do, or certain decisions that we made. And we know that the same way we don't want people to judge us, and even though we know that they don't know the whole story, the same way we have to be dan mekaf schus to others. We can't be worried so much and nitpicking, and this person did that, and this person did that, and they could have done differently. You don't have to worry about other people so much. Let them, give them the benefit of the doubt, and you'll judge them favorably. I'll tell you an amazing story about Dan Lekaf Schus that a friend of mine one time told me. This story happened a number of years ago when he was a bachur, and he went up to camp. He was in the city for the summer, maybe he was in a bungalow colony, and he wanted to visit a friend of his in the mountains that was in a camp. So he got for Shabbos. So he got permission to come to Shabbos, to that camp for Shabbos. He didn't know anybody in the camp except for his friend, but he got permission to eat the meals there and have a bed. There was an empty bed for Shabbos, so he came to this specific camp for Shabbos. So he comes to the camp, comes to the shul Friday night. After davening is over, the head counselor or the rav, whatever it was, the Marid Asra, was standing at the front of the shul in the camp, and everybody in the camp, they were walking around saying good Shabbos to the rav, to the Marid Asra, the head of the rav in that particular camp. And my friend, he told me that he noticed one guy off to the side, and he wasn't going around saying good Shabbos. He wasn't saying good Shabbos like everybody else. He was off to the side. Not only was he off to the side, but he looked like a cool cat. He was leaning back on a shtender, and he was leaning like this on a shtender, and his hat was up, like with his big chub, and you know, and it bothered him, like it irked him, like, who is this guy? Who does he think he is? Like, everyone's going around saying good Shabbos. He's not going around saying good Shabbos. And he's leaning on the shtender as if, you know, he's God's gift to mankind, and with his hat up. And see, he asked his friend, he says, who is this? What's with this guy? Who is he? What's he doing? How come, you know, why is he different than everybody else? So he says, him. He says, he has yana machla. He said, he's so weak, he can't even walk around the shul. He says he has to stay off to the side. He pushed it. He can hardly move. Not only can't he move, but he can hardly even stand up. He has to lean on his shtender. He has to lean on the table on a chair because he doesn't have the strength to stand up all by himself. And because of all the chemotherapy that he's had, he's losing all his hair in the back of his head. So he always wears his hat up to cover the back of his hair, the back of his head, because he's embarrassed of the hair that he's missing in the back of his head. And my friend told me, he said, he was speechless. He said, every single thing that he was bothered by this guy, that he wasn't walking around saying a Shabbos, that he wasn't standing straight up, he was leaning back on the shtender, that he had his hat up like a cool cat, everything was answered all in one shot. How's he supposed to know? But not that we need to, you know, guess that person, you know, is sick with a terrible machlo. But he said it was such a lesson to him in down the kaf schus that there are so many times that we don't know the whole story. I know for myself, I'm a Moyo, and when I moved back to America, I moved back about 5.5 years ago, and you know, I was a Moyo in Eretz Yisrael, but then I moved back to America, and I was starting over the Bris Milah, and a friend of mine who lived in Passaic. I heard that he had a boy. I knew that his wife was expecting, and I heard that he had a boy. And, you know, I'm waiting for a phone call, you know, so he could use me as the mayo. And no phone call came, and I was like, okay, fine. You know, maybe some people don't call the first day. They wait, and maybe they wait till the wife is home from the hospital. You know, no phone calls. You know, still a few days, and I'm like, you know, what's going on? I thought we're friends. You know, what's going on? Finally, you know, I saw another friend of ours. And I said, oh, you heard so-and-so had a baby? He said, yeah, very nice, yeah, Baruch Hashem, he had a baby girl. I said, oh, it was a girl? He said, yeah, it was a girl. I said, oh, I heard it was a boy. He says, no, it wasn't a boy, it was a girl. But, okay, that explains it right there. So, you know, I heard he had a boy. I can't say I blame myself for you know, not thinking, oh, maybe it really was a girl. But here, you know, here I was already judging him, you know, all different excuses, maybe, you know, why not? But here, you know, you see that I didn't necessarily know the whole story. Nowadays, you know, the past few months we've had so many tragedies in Klal Yisrael, and even though I said, you know, we have so much to focus on the positive, Hashem does so much good for us. Hashem does so many chasadim for us and for Klal Yisrael, and we have to focus on the positive. But we do all know that in the past few months there have been many tragedies in Klal Yisrael. Many Rosh Hashivas have been nifter, Nechuda Lefkowitz, Reb Chaim Stein, Reb Kuppelman, Abu Chatzira, and Reb Dov Schwartzman, and my own Rosh Hashiva, Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, that I was very close to, went to the Mir for 8 years, and was very close to him, and you know, he suddenly had a heart attack, was nifter. I have a brother that lives in Waterbury, and you know, I don't know if you heard about the accident with the boys who were driving back to Waterbury. Two boys died, and some of my brother's talmidim were very injured. The van fell on his elbow, and the stitches, and it was a terrible accident that they were driving back to yeshiva. The boy in Lakewood, the 2-year-old boy whose the mother was a very good friend of my wife's, he swallowed a balloon and he choked and he died. So many different tragedies. And here in Borough Park, we all know the story of Leiby Kaletsky. So many different tragedies that's happening in Klal Yisrael. And all of us, as good Yidden, we want to help. We would give anything to be able, if someone would say, if you would do this and this, and it would have prevented, you know, a tragedy from happening, we would do anything, you know, just to prevent, to stop one of these things from happening. I remember when, by the Twin Towers, about a little more than 10 years ago, growing up, my father always used to say, you know, I remember where, everyone remembers where they were when Kennedy was shot. So nowadays we say, nah, everyone remembers where they were when they heard about the Twin Towers. So I remember where I was when we heard about the Twin Towers. I was in Eretz Yisrael, I was a Bochur. No, I had just been married, and I was learning in Eretz Yisrael. I just got married, moved back to Eretz Yisrael. And I was learning, I was in the mirror, I was my Rebbe, Rabbi Asher Arieli, he gives shir at 5:50 in the evening, from 5:50 to 7 o'clock. So 5:50 in Eretz Yisrael is, in America, 7 hours earlier. So it was just a few hours after the Twin Towers had happened. I sat in what's called the maklat, I sat in the basement in the mirror, and as the guy started coming down to shir, a lot of Americans, out of the 300 guys in the shir, about 150 were American, they started saying that the Twin Towers was hit with airplanes. I was like, no way. It's like, not possible. You're talking about a book, you're talking about a movie. I'm saying, like, it's, of course. And as people came down, you know, they realized that it was true. Rabbi Shariyeli, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he lives in Sanej Mechavim, he's a big Talmud Chacham, big Tzaddik. He has no idea what the Twin Towers are. So one of the Americans, one of my friends, he went over to Shir, before the Shir started, he went over to Rabbi Shamieli, and he said, he just explained to him what the Twin Towers is all about, what Manhattan is. He's never been out of Eretz Yisrael, and what exactly Manhattan is, and what is the Twin Towers. He said, you have to say something about it. I mean, Rabbi Shir, I'm sure, I don't expect you to know about Rabbi Shamieli, but he never left, you know, he just said Shir. He never spoke about other things except when Rav Shach was Nifter and this time of the Twin Towers. And one of the Americans said, you have to say something about the Twin Towers. So he came down and everyone was waiting to see what Rav Asher is going to say about, you know, the Twin Towers. And he said that, he said, listen, what could we do in Eretz Yisrael? We're far away. We know that there's some Yidden in the Twin Towers. What could we do from far away? And he said, there's one thing that we could do from far away. He says that is to strengthen ourselves in Torah and Tefillah. And Torah, because he was talking to a bunch of Yeshiva Bachram and Young Light, you know, for the Chizuk and learning Torah, but this also counts for setting up Shiurim, and Tefillah, and davening, and being strong in mitzvos, and Bein Adam L'Chaveru, and complimenting people, and not getting upset, and being Moichel, and forgiving other people. Anytime we strengthen ourselves in Torah and mitzvos, Rabbi Aaron Kotler used to always say, and the Nefesh HaChaim, Rabbi Chaim Volozhin always say, any mitzvah that a person does has an effect, can save somebody else from far, even far away. And yes, we had a number of tragedies, but we definitely could have had more. Hashem could have had more. Any mitzvah, any time a person looks away when somebody could have, when somebody did something to them, and they don't answer back, and they look away, that is a mitzvah that is unparalleled, and that itself, that can prevent more tzaras from happening in Klal Yisrael. And we'll never know about it. We'll never know about it. So you don't necessarily get that good feeling of, oh, I know I did something right, and I know I just saved the Yiddish and Neshama in Klal Yisrael. We won't know necessarily. But there could be somebody who was sick far away, and they didn't end up dying because of this shir that's happening tonight. We have girls coming, taking out of the busy schedule to come for a shir, however often it is, once a week, once a month, whatever it is, everything is so amazing, it's so special, every mitzvah. And that itself can have an effect and prevent any tzara in Klal Yisrael. I know, just to end with this story that happened with me a few months ago, and it was a great lesson for me. As I said, I'm a mile, and a few months ago I was called, the person actually called my father. My father passed it on to me because he wasn't available. There was a boy, a baby that was born, and he wasn't able to have his bris at the regular time. He was born with something special, something different, that he needed to have a surgery when he was 6 or 7 months old. And what the parents wanted is that they needed a mohel to be in the operation room by the surgery, and just that the mohel would do the actual bris, and then the doctor would do the rest of the surgery. So fine. So they had to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning. I didn't have to be there till 7 o'clock in the morning. The surgery was called for 7 o'clock in the morning, and I got there, and I noticed that the doctor that was performing the surgery, I was able to tell that he was a Yid. He was not Frum, so he wasn't able to be the one to do the actual bris, but I was able to tell that he was a Yid. His last name was you know, a type of name that was Jewish, and he talked as if he was a Jew, but not a Frum Jew. So really, what he was doing was against the rules of the hospital. I'm on staff in other hospitals, but I'm not on staff I was not on staff in that particular hospital. And really, that I should assist in the operation, assist on the surgery, really was bending the rules a little bit. And he told the nurses that are there, the anesthesiologist happened to be a Frum guy, but the other nurses that were there, he told them, he said, you know, you guys, you close your eyes when we bend the rules, because, you know, I really was not allowed to be doing what I was doing, but it's not a big deal. I was just doing just a little bit just to do the actual bris, and then he would do the rest of the surgery, you know, which took about 2 hours. I stayed an extra half hour just to watch. So after that, I did the bris. I made the bracha. And after about a half hour, when I left, I thanked him, you know, for bending the rules for us. And, you know, I thanked him on behalf of the parents that he bent the rules, that this way I was able to do the bris, and they were able to have a kosher bris done by a mile. And I thanked him for it. And I told him, you should just know that you did a big mitzvah. I was able to tell him, he knew what a mitzvah was. I said, you did a big mitzvah. And he says, you know, I feel good about what I did. And it was such a lesson to me, because here's a guy who was totally not from, not religious, maybe he was reformer, or he was probably totally not traditional at best, he was not religious whatsoever. But any mitzvah, he knew he did a mitzvah. He knew he did something right. the hospital, I didn't care. It was just, I wasn't doing anything major. But for the sake of the mitzvah of Bris Milah, he knew that he did something right. And he felt it deep down inside of him. It wasn't even so deep. Inside, he knew that he was doing the right thing. And again, that idea that I was speaking about, that when you know you're doing the correct thing, you feel good about yourself. And there's nothing like, you know, it's enjoyable to eat a good piece of steak, or, okay, that's maybe guys like to eat a piece of steak, but whatever you like, a good piece of food, something gashmias that you really like, but there's nothing compares to when you know you did a good mitzvah. You came out to a shir, you davened a Shemona Esrei, when you take the 3 steps back, you know, that was good. I didn't space out so much. I had kavana, and I was able to daven. You know you did the proper thing, and it's the best feeling in the world. And you know that you're able to get closer to your neshama when you know, as they say, you helped the old lady across the street with her bags. I never seen anyone actually help an old lady across the street with her bags, but that's just what we call when you know you did a mitzvah and you feel good about it. And my bracha to all of you is in the schus that you're coming here to want to grow and to get inspired, and you continue that Hashem Shetaka answer all your tefillos and any tears that you have throughout the year for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, whenever it is, that Hashem Shetaka answer all your tefillos, and we should have all the simchas and fires.